RadioInfluence.com. You are sitting ringside with David Penzer on Radio Influence.
Welcome to Sitting Ringside. David Penzer back with you with another week of fun and excitement. And I have a confession to make. I'm going to open the show with a confession. I'm going to give you a little background on my confession. You know, when you're doing a show like this, or you're doing anything that's journalistic, really, you try to get scoops. Everybody wants to get scoops. For example, I'm a Rays fan. People who follow me on social media know that, Tampa Bay Rays. Colby Rasmus, as we tape this, just retired for the season. I'm sure that every reporter and every journalist is trying to get the scoop as to why he walked away from baseball. That's what people do. That's where the money is. You want to get the scoop. I don't think I'm telling anybody anything they don't know. So, for example, when I was at WrestleCade last November, thinking about doing a podcast this year, and was shooting the shit with Nick Patrick, and I asked him, hey, Nick, you mind if I ask you what happened at Starcade? Because we never really talked about it. And he told me. And I said, Nick, if I ever do a podcast, have you ever told that story before? He said, no, never been able to. I said, if I ever do a podcast, will you come on my podcast and tell that story? He said, sure. So notice who we had as the second guest of Sitting Ringside. I was trying to get a scoop. So I'm going to give a scoop about myself. And 25 plus years in the wrestling business, and most of my life is a open book. But you know, some things you keep secret, not for public knowledge. I think only my closest family members know what I'm about to tell you. So, I did some thinking recently, and I had to decide how this would affect my status in the wrestling business, if I have any. I guess I do. I'm the ring announcer for Global Force Wrestling Impact, as it's now called. And I have a podcast. Thank you for listening, by the way. Really appreciate it. Just want to take a moment to say that before my confession. So I had to decide how this would affect my family, you know, because I have a wife and two kids and mother and father and brother and sister. And I had to think about how this would affect my businesses because, you know, I'm a realtor and have a couple other side businesses. So put a lot of thought in this and slept on it for a couple of days. And, you know, I just decided sometimes it's better to come out clean and say it. And so, ladies and gentlemen, what nobody other than my family and close personal friends know about me in my time in the wrestling business is, I hope that I'm doing the right thing now. I, David Penzer, have been a subscriber to the Wrestling Observer newsletter for 30 years. There, I said it. I got it out in the open. I said it. And the funny thing is you laugh, you know, I hope you laugh, or you snicker, or you roll your eyes, or you say, you know, I thought he was going to say something important. Back in the day, nobody wanted to know, people to know they were reading the Observer, but they were all reading it. It was like the worst secret in the world. The boys didn't want to be known that they were reading the Wrestling Observer because they didn't want the office to know because they thought they'd get heat with the office. The office was reading it themselves. They would have some, you know, their wife or their secretary was subscribed to it in their name, and then they would read it. And it was like sort of the worst kept secret, and people did that dance for a lot of years until everybody sort of, once the internet came along and the Wrestling Observer newsletter wasn't that big of a deal anymore because it was all on the internet and they gave it all away. They gave away the scoops. So I will admit I have been subscribing recently on and off, but mostly on, but all the way back to the day. And back in the day, that would have gotten me a ton of heat, but I wouldn't have had a podcast to confess my sins to, and so nobody would have known. So why do you ask, am I confessing this now? Because recently I watched the IWGP New Japan Long Beach show live. I missed the first couple of matches, and I missed the end of the main event to hang out and party with Don West, by the way. That was priority number one that weekend, was to drink alcohol, vodka with Don West, and mission accomplished. And Keith Mitchell was there, so it was even better. So I missed the end of the Cody Rhodes Okada match. Full truth, I very, very rarely watch the shows on Axis. I tape them, I DVR them, I'm just very busy. And I'm obsessed with political and news and the Rays, so I have very little room for much else these days other than work and my family. So I got a chance to watch it. I was in Orlando, nothing going on, and waiting for Don West to call me and tell me that he was ready to have a couple cocktails. And so I watched the show from my hotel in Orlando, and it was okay. It was cool to see David Finlay. For those of you who don't know, Fit Finlay is has been for, 20 years and continues to be a close personal family friend. We grew up as neighbors, basically, when we worked for WCW. So my oldest son and David, his oldest son, were friends. So I saw the kid literally grow up before my eyes, excuse me. So it was fun to see him. I had never really gotten a chance to see him, and did a great job, but it was an 8-man tag, so it couldn't do all that much, but so different from his father. I was kind of expecting, similar style to his dad, but he's sort of taken his own style. Good for him. So it was great to see him. And I think he's a fourth generation wrestler, which is really literally unheard of. And I was just recently visiting Castle El Finley in suburban South Atlanta, Georgia. And he has two younger kids, one who's a beautiful girl and another who's the youngest boy. And they all want to be in the wrestling business, too. So I think you're going to see a lot of the Finleys in the future in the world of professional wrestling, fourth generation wrestlers. And if they're anything like their father, they're all tough as nails. But I digress, as I do at times here on Sitting Ringside. So I watched the show, and I don't know most of the players other than the Americans, and really impressed by Zach Sabre Jr., I believe how that's pronounced. He reminded me of what I thought David Finlay would be. A Fit Finlay, William Regal, Steven Regal type of European submission wrestler, who tough as nails as well. So I was very impressed by him, for those who are keeping score. And but the reason I bring up Wrestling Observer Newsletter and my confession, by the way, not only am I a reader, but for the last 5 years, I've gotten to vote on who goes in the Hall of Fame. Nobody knows that because I never admitted that I was a subscriber. So thank you, Dave Meltzer, for considering me. I don't know what I am, but I guess I'm important enough to have a say in that. So that's always cool when I get that every year. Get to the point, Penzer. I wanted to hate Kenny Omega. I'm just going to be honest with you. I wanted to hate him. And why would you want to hate Kenny Omega, the people out in podcast land say? As much as I love Dave Meltzer, I don't know him that well. I see him at shows. I haven't seen him in years, but I'll see him at a show and I'll say hello. I think the only time I really spoke to Dave Meltzer was when the Chris Benoit thing happened that we talked about on our first episode. I don't want to over-talk about that. But just because I was so involved, I almost wanted to, he reached out to me and I wanted to quell a lot of things that were being said that were inaccurate. I could have gone on Dateline NBC or Nancy Grace. I was invited on those shows, but I chose not to participate in that madness. But that was about the only time I ever gave Meltzer any kind of information. So I'd say hello and goodbye. I like the guy. He's a nice guy. God bless him. And I'm sorry for his loss of his father recently. But Dave Meltzer, every once in a while, will grab onto a wrestler, usually a strong style Japanese wrestler, and go crazy over the guy. And in turn, a lot of the people on the internet, or back then his subscribers, will become fans, because Dave is well respected, and for good reason, as a voice in the business. So as a person in the wrestling business, you almost want, he put over Kenny Omega, 6-star match. I had never heard. I didn't know there was such thing. I thought it was only 5 stars. He had a 6-star match. I still never seen that match, but I will have to. It's on my list of things to do that's a mile long. I wanted to not like Kenny Omega. I wanted to be unimpressed because you want to say, ah, it's just another Meltzer guy that he fell in love with. Everybody stands in line and gets, you know, follows behind. So I watched his match. He's a hell of a worker, guys. I didn't see that 6-star match, but I did see the match that he had that night. And the guy has it. Whether he's the next John Cena, God only knows. Whether, you know, he's a player in WWE down the line, I can't predict. But the guy's talented. And part of me was hoping that I wouldn't think he was. So just wanted to give you that insight. Enjoyed most of the show, for those who care. I thought the Cody match built pretty nicely, and then I missed the end because I had something on my bucket list that was more important for me to do. But Kenny Omega is the real deal. For what little it matters, I have now said it out loud and confessed my sins of being a subscriber of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter and admitted that I vote on the Hall of Fame every year. And now I will be shunned from the professional wrestling business for the rest of my life. So those are my thoughts on that. Every once in a while, I just like to give you my thoughts on something going on in the wrestling business that isn't having a conversation with an old friend like we're going to do here in just a little bit and tell you my thoughts. So for those of you who, I'm curious, what are your thoughts of Kenny Omega? Hit me up on at David Penzer on Twitter or at Penzer Ringside. Let me know what your thoughts on Kenny Omega are. How far do you think he'll go in WWE? You think he'll be champion? How about Nakamura? Do you think he'll be champion? My quick thoughts on Nakamura is the guy has all the ability and charisma in the world. I think they should give him a mouthpiece. I don't know who that mouthpiece should be. The obvious mouthpiece is Paul Heyman. But if you want to build him as a babyface, I don't know how you really do that because Paul Heyman's more of a at least tweener like he is now. So I don't know. I thought about that. If you're going to give him a mouthpiece, who do you give Nakamura to talk for him? But until his promos get better, and it's not his fault, he's learned a new language. I think they should give him a mouthpiece, but I think he has everything it takes to be a player in this business, including an entrance music that used to be unthinkable that people would sing an entrance music during a match, let alone while they were coming to the ring. Could you imagine if people would have sung 2001 A Space Odyssey while Ric Flair was wrestling? Or Pomp and Circumstance for Macho Man Randy Savage, which, by the way, if anybody cares, was my favorite entrance music of all time to announce. Gives me chills to this day. I just thought it was perfect for who was coming out. But so that's my thought on that. Let me know what you think. Who'd be a good voice for Nakamura for now, if not Paul Heyman? And let me know what you think of Kenny Omega and his future, and if you think I'm spot on or you think I'm full of it. I'm a big boy. I could take it. I love to engage in debate and discussion, and nobody ever is wrong. Everybody's entitled to their opinion. That's what makes this country great. So I'll get off my soapbox now, and we will talk to our first guest, who I am extremely excited to have on. I'm going to tell you a little secret before we tape this. And it'll be edited out, so you'll never hear it if it doesn't happen. But I'm actually hoping we could get a 2-parter or even 3-parter with this band because there's so much to talk about. What an amazing career. Part of the Monday Night Wars and involved in so much leading up to that. And even some stuff afterwards. So thank you for indulging me on my little rant and my confession. And right now, I want to bring on a good friend. Do you remember, Kevin, that when you were booking Monday Night Show for WCW, that I used to dictate the shows to me sometimes, and I used to write them out?
Yes, I did, David, and you were always a smart guy from the time you got into the business. You observed. Most guys don't observe, and you were very good at observing what was good and what was wrong. Because most guys can be in the business 20 years, and they still don't know if it's good or bad. You know what I mean? And you did a great job.
See, I could end this right now because Kevin Sullivan just put me over. Ladies and gentlemen, the legendary Taskmaster Booker Man, Devil himself, Kevin Sullivan, welcome to City Ringside. It's an honor to have you. And when I first thought about doing this little podcast here, one of the first people I thought about having on was you, and because you got a ton of stuff to talk about, and I want to talk. So let's talk. I thank you for your time. Great. To start out with. Kevin Sullivan in high school in Boston, Massachusetts, was an amateur wrestler, correct?
Right, okay. Right.
Take me from there as far as how you got in the wrestling business. Were you college? Did you wrestle amateur in college?
No, it's a funny thing. I was going to go to BU, and I was going to wrestle at BU. But I had wrestling was big in Boston at the time in New England.
Amateur wrestling.
And I wrestled. Yeah, and I wrestled for the Cambridge Y, my high school, and the Boston YMC Union, not A, YMC Union. It's the second oldest athletic club in the United States. And I'd see the pro wrestlers there working out weights, you know.
Right.
But I never saw them on the mats. So I was working out one day with a couple of guys, friends of mine, and this guy came over. He was older. He was probably your age.
Oh, thanks.
at the time, David, you know, and he said to me, "You want to work out?" And he was not a big guy. He was about 165, 175 pounds, but really ripped. So we started training together. I'd meet him and wrestle, and he was going to the gym every day because he also played squash, and squash was a huge thing up in New England. So I would wrestle him. I tried to play squash a little. I played a little squash. So we became friends, and his first name was Peter, and his last name was DeBerry. He was from the DeBerry diamond mines in South Africa.
Oh, wow.
All he wanted to be was a pro wrestler, but at that place in South Africa, that would be, you know, at that time, there was a real division in that country. You know, there was apartheid, but there was also a division where it was almost like an aristocratic, you know, middle class.
Right.
And wrestling was beneath him. So he ended up coming to the United States, graduated from Oxford and Harvard Business School. He was a model for Arrow shirts. Remember the Arrow shirt ads?
Yes, sir.
You probably don't. Okay. He was a model for that handsome guy. He lived in New York City on East 52nd Street, where Jacqueline Kennedy lived. So he was filthy rich. And he said to me, "Would you like to learn how to wrestle?" I said, "Yeah, sure." He says, "I wrestle. They pay me a couple of bucks. I don't care about the money. But if you want, you can come up." And I used to train in Williamsburg, which now in New York is the most trendiest place to be, in Brooklyn, right? When I was there, the gym I was at was 234 Broadway upstairs. I was the only Anglo in the gym. It was Pedro Morales trained there, Johnny Rods, Ramon Perez. You know, Isaac Rosario, Carlos Colon. So I was the only Anglo there, and I actually learned to speak Spanish there. So, and it was a dump, but I enjoyed it. And you train, you go up and you train. I come from Boston, and I would drive, and I work out on Friday and Saturday, and you wrestle Friday and Saturday night at this little building. that held about 300 people. So, you know, we go through the matches, and it was like, and here's what was cool. Right around the corner was an old theater, and I used to go and see the El Santo movies, you know, the Lucha Libre movies.
Yeah, those were a little bit before my time, but I've heard of them. I'm very familiar with them.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, there was Lucha, El Santo, there was Mil Mascaras, there was Blue Demon.
Right.
And here's something funny that I found out. Do you know the first guy to wear a mask in Mexico was an American?
Who was that?
His name was Dizzy Davis. You know what else Dizzy Davis did? After he gave up the mask, he lost a match with a mask, right?
Mm-hmm.
He came back in this flamboyant outfit. He lived in Houston, and another wrestler lived at the end of the street. And the wrestler said, "Are you going to use that gimmick here in the States?" He says, "No, it'll never get over." The other wrestler's name was George Wagner.
I was thinking Gorgeous George. Unreal.
Yeah. So, you know, the history of Lucha Libre might have been different if he didn't come down with the mask, you know? So I learned how to wrestle there, and I knew finishes. So finally I get to go to Montreal with Peter, and I'm booked there with another legend. His name, Pat Patterson, learned to wrestle there. Ronnie Garvin wrestled there. Terry Garvin learned to wrestle there. Yeah, it was like there was always two promotions. There was the main promotion in Montreal, which had television. And this guy's name was Pat Girard, but he wrestled as Pat Curry. And this guy was the biggest star at one time in England. He had a chauffeured Rolls Royce.
Wow.
And this was the late 30s and before World War II happened. So I get to, this is a funny story. I get there and Peter's on the card, and they put me for some reason like on the third match because I was wrestling a guy. And the funny thing was they would let the main stars wrestle on Pat's card because Pat was a legend. And I was wrestling a guy named Bernard Fichette, who was a big name up there. And they're getting ready, and, you know, but an hour goes by, is an hour closer to the show, and I said to Peter, "Somebody going to tell me what's going over here?" He said, "Yeah, I'm sure the promoter will." And you got to realize the number one language in Montreal is French.
French, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm waiting for somebody, and I said to one of the referees going by, I said, "Excuse me, could you please tell me what's going on?" A moment, couldn't speak, went by. Anyway, the third match comes on. I still don't know the finish, but I figure I'm going to do the job, right?
Correct.
And I wasn't really properly trained some of the moves. So I'm working with him, and I potatoed him, and he was very nice.
Like that's the only time that ever happened in your career, correct?
Yeah, I happened one other time, I think. I potatoed him, and he rolled to the apron to get a hold of himself, and I panicked. I didn't know what to do. And I hit the ropes. You know, I saw that you could pull guys in, you know, the slingshot in.
Right.
Well, I blew that spot. I hit the ropes as hard as I could, and I was probably coming off the ropes at 30 miles an hour, and I knocked him back into the third row. He got up, and he was swearing in French, and they swear differently. They use Catholic symbols, Tabernacle, the Mandawi, and he went in off of this tangent and left the ring, and I jump up on the second turnbuckle, and I'm yelling, "Please come back. Please come back. Please come back."
You didn't want any heat on you.
Yeah, so I go in the dressing room. I figure I'm going to get my ass handed to me. And he's got the referee corner and said, "You didn't tell this kid the finish?" He said, "Well, we didn't know what to say to him, how much we should say." He said, "Listen, besides him hurting me, I could have hurt him, and the three of us could get hurt." And he didn't take it out on me, and he said, "Hey, come up next week, come up early, and we'll go through, and we'll have another match, and be good." So I was lucky I got into the business that way, and after that, I had a chance to go, miraculously, I ended up getting booked from there to West Virginia, and then from West Virginia, I went to Atlanta, and between West Virginia and Atlanta, I was in a territory started up in the in South Carolina, right? That right. had TV. A guy that you know very well, his brother owned it, and him and I were roommates. You'll never guess who it was.
Ron Fuller.
Dutch Mantell.
Oh, really? He owned the territory?
Yeah. Dutch's brother owned South Carolina, had TV. Yeah.
Oh, I had no idea.
And then the Crocketts came over and they took me first, and then they took Dutch, and they took some of the other guys and sent them to different territories to break up. You know, they didn't want any competition.
Let's go back let's go back for a moment. The Montreal, what year would that have been?
That was 70,
1970. And do you think that the reason why the guy who lost by countout because nobody told you to finish, do you think the reason why he said come early, we'll go over it? Do you think he was trying to be nice, or you think he wanted his win back in Montreal?
No, I think that back in those days, I think the guys, like I tell stories, when I went to Georgia, I'd wrestle on the first match with guys that were leaving the business. And I'd go 20 minutes or 15, whatever the time limit was. And I remember saying something stupid to this guy named Dr. Timothy Gohagan. He was a real doctor, and he was from Ireland. And I thought maybe an Irisher could say something stupid, I guess. I said, "Hey, does that sleeper really work?" Well, with 10 seconds left to go in the match, I was out. He put me out. They woke me up, and I came back, and I said, "Sorry about that, sir." And they would rub your nose in because you were going to take their job. But if you lasted a couple of weeks, then they would start saying, "Hey, kid, I'm going to give you a spot tonight." Besides that, they would just eat you alive. So the business has changed quite a bit.
So let me ask you a question. Did you ever wrestle under any other name than Kevin Sullivan, the Taskman? You know, we know all the names, nicknames.
This is why I can't stand the internet. They got about 12 names I wrestled under. One of them was Kevin Caldwell. My partner was Whitey Caldwell. I don't know how they ever got me as a Caldwell. But when I one of the earlier territories, I went to wrestle Montreal a few times, and like I said, South Carolina a few times, and West Virginia a few times, but when I in Atlanta for a few months, and then when I went to Pensacola, back in the day, they had a heel named Eddie Sullivan. That wasn't his real name. He was a Mexican guy, but they didn't want a baby face named Sullivan, so they gave me the name Johnny West, and that was the only time in my life I was Johnny West.
Johnny West.
So I've only, yeah.
And
the thing is, the promoter got that off a cartoon show. It used to be Johnny Quest.
Quest, yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming it's about this time that you hit Florida for the first time?
No, I actually went from there to... I was lucky in my career. I was very lucky. I was teamed up in Pensacola with... There's two legends in that area. One of them was Cowboy Bob Kelly, but the big one was Ken Lucas.
Of course.
And, you know, Ken Lucas, Jack Briscoe said he was one of the five greatest opponents he ever had. And wow, that says something. Yeah. Kenny, I saw him and Bobby Shane. And you know the name Bobby Shane,
yes,
David.
Sir.
I saw him go 40 minutes with Jack Briscoe before they threw a punch. I saw him do the same thing with Lucas. And then they went 40 minutes without a punch being thrown. And at the 50-minute mark, they stopped the match for too much blood. It was brilliantly done. Brilliantly done. So they put me with Ken and put the belts on us, and I learned just being by osmosis, being in his corner. Then I went to Nashville, and there used to be an old-timer, and he's still alive, and he's a wonderful guy named Len Rossi, and he needed a shot in the arm, so they gave him a young baby face so he could make the comebacks, and I learned a lot from him. And then when I was there, I was also working with Robert Fuller some, and Ronald Fuller was there, and Robert's dad bought part of Florida, and Ronald said, would you like to go? We don't know what's going to happen, but you're willing to go, and if that doesn't work out, we'll send you to Australia. So when I went down there, I lucked out. Mike was there, and they put me with Mike for 2 years.
So Mike Graham, lucky, so to speak.
Yeah.
You both had similar Mike builds, Graham. Correct?
Yeah, we were both into powerlifting, and, you know, Mike was a big amateur wrestler, and Mike was a dear friend of mine. I mean, he was just, he treated me aces, because when I was at the team, we were the champions. When we lost the belts, I'd always lose the belt, right? Because that's Michael's home turf.
Yes.
Mike, after that, because who Eddie was, Mike would get himself booked in every territory I was in, and he would go around for a week and do a job for me, and not only do a job, he'd be bloodied and carried out. Yeah.
Yeah, he was a good guy. I got to know him pretty well.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it's funny. I was digging up some, now on the internet, you could find everything. And I dug up the first wrestling show I ever went to as a kid. I was 11 years old. It was May 13th, 1977. And it was at the Fort Lauderdale National Guard Armory. I'm sure you remember that well, because there was no air conditioning and you were in Fort Lauderdale. So double main event. The main event was Ernie Ladd and Ox Baker, and the co-main event was Siegfried Stanky and Hans Schroeder against you and Mike Graham. That would have been 77.
Yeah, I went back 77 for a short time. I had been in New York, and I had stayed there for 13 months. And I could have gone to L.A. In fact, Vince Sr. said to me, you know, you've been here a long time. He said, you guys in the position, my position was the guy to get the guy over to work with Bruno. He kept me very good on TV, and especially good on the house shows like Spiros Arion. When Spiros was going out, Spiros did jobs for me. Different guys like that. Bugsy, it was a heel up there. He did jobs for me. Blackwell did jobs for me.
So as always, sorry to interrupt, but as always, I got ahead of myself. So after Florida, we'll get back to 77, because I have a question about the Fort Lauderdale National Guard Armory. But But so you're in Florida. You and Mike Graham had a 2-year run. Vince Sr. calls you or one of his guys?
No. What happened was I went to North Carolina. And because I had been Mike's partner in Dusty turned into the American Dream.
Correct.
And they put Mike with Dusty and they came to me. It was business over 2 years. And they said, where do you want to go? And I said, Carolinas. And I went to the Carolinas and things didn't work out for political reasons. I did some stupid things as a kid. And I ended up going to Vince and he liked me. And he put me with Calhoun. He put me with Andre. I was in against the Executioners in tag matches. But mostly my job was to get the guy ready to wrestle with Bruno. Before Hanson wrestled Bruno, I did a job for Hanson. Same thing for Brody. Same thing for Ernie Ladd. Ken Patera, but on the way out, like the guys, like a wonderful guy, Spiros Arion, he put me over in all the smaller towns, you know?
Right.
So he kept me good there. So a guy in my position would only last about 6 months. But they actually gave me a chance to talk a little. And they usually didn't give, you know, young baby faces a chance to talk. But I had been in Florida and watched some of the greatest talkers. And I'm not saying I was good, but I was more than passable to some of them. And they kept me there. And the old man came to me and he said, you've been here for 13. That wasn't me. That was the ferry going.
Yeah,
by.
The ferry. I was going to point that out.
Yeah. The old man came to me and said, you've been here 13 months. I usually keep a guy in this position 6. He had actually taught me how to book a little.
Vince Sr., you're talking about.
Yeah, I'll tell you what happened.
Please do.
You know where they filmed the original Rocky, the old Philly Arena?
Yes, sir.
The Rocky one? We used to do our TVs there. So I got there early one day. I was the first guy in there. And Vince had a table where all his cronies sat. And nobody was in there. And I opened his book. And I used this for my template. I opened this book. And I went to the end of the year. And he had, in Madison Square Garden, all the big shows, because there was no internet, were the same 3 matches, right?
Right.
And he had Madison Square, the main event, Bruno. He had the tag team, and he had the guy that was going to go up to wrestle Bruno soon. And he had written down Hanson for 3 matches, Brody for 2, Bull Ramos for 1. The Kentucky Butcher for 1, and the card was booked a year in advance, and he caught me, and I didn't know whether shit or go blind, and he said, what are you doing? I said, sir, I just was trying to look at this. I don't know how you do this. He said, you want to find out how to do it? I said, yeah. He said, well, sit down. You talk about heat. I mean, I had heat, nuclear heat, not from the boys because they didn't give a shit. It was his cronies. What was I doing sitting at that table? You know what I mean? So I watched how he did things, and he would take a guy and say, I can get 3 matches from him, but I'll come back and give Bruno a solid win with a guy that, like, right, Bull Ramos, while he was getting Ramos over, Ramos never took a bump. He would get a pop. He wrestled Edouard Carpentier, who was, you know, he's a legend.
Right.
Of, you know, He drop kicked this guy four times. He staggered. And in the fourth one, he hit the ropes and bounced back off the ropes and didn't go down. And the people popped, right? And I said to myself, this guy, Edward Carpentier, is one of the foremost drawers in the business. Why would he do that? Well, I watched the match the next show. Bruno attacked him. The bull attacked Bruno. Bruno made his comeback the way he used to and picked him up and slammed him. You would have thought it was Hogan slamming the Giant. He just knew what his people wanted. And the other thing was, he got a lot of, if he had a question, he'd call Eddie Graham. They were very, very close friends. Eddie had drawn a huge amount of money with them with Rocker and Perez against the Grahams.
Eddie and Jerry Graham, correct?
Yeah, and Eddie, when Vince had it, I'll tell you another story. Eddie would give Vince ideas and angles.
Right.
Mike and Eddie got to a point where there was some heat there, and I was in the middle of it because the three of us used to go fishing, and Mike was pissed off at his father about something, and the only three people that knew about this were me, Terry Funk, Janie Ingalls, and Jim Barnett. And I was in a bad spot because Mike and I are very close, and Eddie is my boss, but he would lean on me and tell me the problems. So I used to go, he used to say to me, I'll fly you to Jacksonville tonight. So come to the office at 12 and we'll go fishing from 12 to 4 and bring your gear and, you know, you can shower at the building. I bet you 10 people don't know this story. When he decided after, you know why he decided to go or get away from the ethnic champion? You got to realize his ethnic, he was brilliant because not only him, but his father, there was always an Irishman on the card, a Jewish wrestler on the card, a German, a Japanese, an Italian, and a Hispanic.
You're back to Vince Sr., correct?
That's not only Vince Sr., that's Jess McMahon. You know what I mean?
His father.
And he followed up on it with TV, okay? So he went with Rocca, and Rocca was a crossover. The Italians loved him, but he grew up in Argentina. And then after he burnt out, it was Bruno. And after he burnt out, it was Pedro.
Puerto Ricans.
Yeah. Pedro was wrestling blackjack in Boston one night, and a guy, a Puerto Rican, had pissed on a knife and hit the ring and gave Jack 187 stitches in his thigh.
Oh, my God.
And he almost lost the leg because of the infection from the urine. So he decided then he was going back to Bruno. But after that, he was looking around for a Jack Briscoe. That's when Jack and the Funks were champions, you know,
right.
The All-American boys. People don't realize this story. Funk used to wear his leather jacket to the ring. You know what I mean? So they were like All-American boys, pre-varsity club, you know, shooters. And they were reminding you they were shooters.
Oh, the varsity jackets.
I come in the office one day, and Eddie's on the phone. He waves me in. And there was two It was a tag team down there. And Eddie is arguing with Vince, and he said, I'm telling you, you go with the other guy. He said, why? He said, the other guy talks better, plus his father's a war hero. You can certainly do something in that. And Eddie put it on the speaker, and Vince Sr. said, I'll get the guy over. I don't care. I'll bring him in for 16 months before he ever wrestles in the arena. That's how close it was of Steve Kern being the WWE champion.
Instead of Bob Backlund.
Yep.
Wow, I never heard that story. Does Steve know that story?
Nope.
Oh, he does now.
I think I might have told him the last time I saw him, but that is how destiny changes your life. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And Bob became a very good champion. The funny thing was, I wrestled Bobby a lot when he was the WWE champion in Florida and in Georgia in babyface matches. They would bring Bobby in. And I don't know why it was babyface matches. Maybe they thought we would gel together, but I worked with them 6 or 7 times. And that was unusual back at the time for NWA, WWF champion wrestling in NWA territory.
So you were in WWF. They gave you 13 months and, you come back to, you make your way at some point back to Florida, where you end up in the Fort Lauderdale National Guard Armory on Friday, May 13th, where this young Jewish kid is seeing his first match. And now you're talking to him many years later. I have been told that Friday night in the Florida territory, for those who don't know, they would split the territory. Half the crew would go to Tallahassee. Correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin. And half the crew would go to Fort Lauderdale. And I think Tallahassee was the bigger city as far as the building. So it would be a better show in Tallahassee, usually, if I remember correctly, than in Fort Lauderdale. It was a small little armory. But I've been told that Mike Graham always preferred to go on Friday nights to Fort Lauderdale. And if you look back on the results of the Fort Lauderdale shows back in the late 70s, early 80s, he's on almost every show. Do you know the inside scoop as to why Mike liked to go to Fort Lauderdale?
Yeah, absolutely. He owned the town. Eddie gave him Fort Lauderdale to promote. He owned the town. I was lucky enough to be his partner. So my payoff in Fort Lauderdale was the same payoff they got on top in Tallahassee. So I was glad not to go to Tallahassee. Fort Lauderdale was a much better party in town.
See, that's
back in the day.
That's what I always assumed. Yeah. I never realized that he owned the city. I always assumed when I heard that he just liked hanging on a Friday night in Fort Lauderdale more than Tallahassee.
First of all, even if I didn't get paid, I certainly would take Fort Lauderdale over Tallahassee, and especially back in the day then, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was wide open, you know what I mean? Florida was wide open. And you got to realize something too, David. Back then, there was only the Tampa Bay Bucks. Now, listen what they got. They got 3 football teams, 2 baseball teams, and 2 hockey teams. And I'm sure they have a couple of soccer teams.
They have a soccer team in Orlando, and an NBA team.
Okay, did I not mention the NBA? There's Orlando, and there's the Magic. There's 2,
and the Heat.
There's a lot of sports teams in the Heat. Yeah, the Heat and the Magic. So you got the Heat, the Magic. That's 2. You got 2 baseball teams. You got 3 football teams, and you got 2 hockey teams, and you got a soccer team. Back then, it was just the Dolphins and us. in us. You know what I mean? And the Dolphins had just come into town because they were an expansion from the old AFL.
So it's funny you say that, Kevin, because I just recently co-promoted with a partner a fan fest here in Tampa called the Championship Wrestling from Florida Fan Fest. And we had Jody Hamilton, the Masked Assassin. We had Steve Kern, who could have been the WWF champion, I just learned. And we had Bugsy McGraw.
Right.
And we paid tribute to Eddie Graham and to Cowboy Luttrell. And my Eddie's granddaughter was there, and Cowboy Luttrell's daughter was there. And of course, for those who aren't familiar, those are the two promoters of this territory up until it folded in 1987. And we'll get back to your comings and goings in Florida later on. But I am promoting, we're promoting CWF Fan Fest 2. And the reason that I said it's funny that you mentioned that is because when I was promoting this fan fest locally, I talked about the fact that the reason why the county commissioners were giving were honoring Cowboy Luttrell and Eddie Graham is because, just like you said, back in the day it was only the Miami Dolphins, and then a little bit later on the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and it was Championship Wrestling from Florida, and. And so that was, you know, now like you talk about, there's so much other franchises. And but I do want to mention for those who are listening that might want to be a part of this, October 28th in Odessa, Florida, which is a suburb of Tampa. We're promoting Championship Wrestling from Florida Fan Fest 2. Hey, it's my podcast. I might as well promote it. Saturday, October 28th. And the headliner is going to be my guest for this podcast that you've been listening to, telling about the early part of his career, the one and only Kevin Sullivan coming back to Tampa. And we do a small, intimate fan fest. We limit it to 200 tickets. It's a lot more than just, you know, stand in line, get an autograph, and walk on by. It's an interactive type of experience. And we're so happy to have Kevin coming by on the on October 28th. So just want to mention that. And if you want to find out more about the Fan Fest, you could either join up for the Championship Wrestling from Florida Archives Facebook page, which if you're a fan of old-time territory wrestling, you'll love. Or you could go on to eventbrite.com and just put in CWF Fan Fest, and it'll pop right up. So that's how you find out more information. But Kevin, we're so happy to have you. And as you're making the point, when you were here, that was the only game in town other than the Miami Dolphins.
Yeah, and I am so happy to be coming home. I mean, I hope I see friends I haven't seen for years, and I make new ones. I'm really happy. I'm proud of you, David, that you're doing something that's not been done. It's very novel. I'm looking forward to having a great time. I'm looking forward to seeing you. I'm looking forward to seeing all the people that I used to know, and we'll meet up again with them. Yeah, so it's going to be great. I'm really looking forward to it.
You have an opportunity to eat dinner with Kevin Sullivan and J.J. Dillon, and talk about the stories you're going to hear that night. You're going to hear some stories today, and you already have, but you're going to get to ask questions as well, and if you have your own questions, we're going to open that up during dinner. But I want to get back to talking about you, my old friend. I don't know that anybody ever told the story that Mike Graham owned the Fort Lauderdale territory. So that's that would be why he wanted to come down. Just a quick question, just to give people a understanding. You said that you would get a Tallahassee type payoff as opposed to a Fort Lauderdale type payoff because you would come and work with Mike and he owned the town. What was the difference back in 1977? What would a Tallahassee payoff be, and what would a regular semi-main event tag team match payoff be if you weren't buddies with the guy who owned the town?
Yeah, it'd be, you'd get if I was getting what I should have been getting in Fort Lauderdale, I'd be getting $100. And because I was Mike's partner who's down, he knew I would I would rib him forever, so it was worth him just to give me the extra $50 and shut my mouth because I was gonna buy the beer that night anyway. So he gave me whatever they were getting paid. If they got $150, if they got $175, I got the same payoff.
So it was about a difference of $50 to $75 bucks, huh?
Yeah. And Mike was a very, very generous guy to a lot of people. And you know what you said about, you know, everybody honoring Eddie Luttrell? Let me tell you a story. That was taken from Funk Sr. Funk Sr. told Eddie this story. Terry and I are very close. You know, he's the most beloved guy in our business.
Love him to death.
He's a treasure. I hope he's still... I'm going to book him on his 100th birthday, and I want to be able to wheel him down to the ring and carry the spike and not drop it. You remember Chainsaw Massacre? I want to be Grandpa. Let Grandpa do it and drop the spike, but... Terry's dad told Eddie because Eddie worked for Senior and he was Buddy Rogers' partner in Amarillo. He went as Rip Rogers and he told, Eddie started the Sheriff's Boys and Girls Ranch.
Right.
Senior had done that. Senior had always told him, do good things for the community to come back to you. David, I had Mayor Greco, I think he's been a couple of terms, but this is 35 years ago, give me an award on the wrestling show. Think about this. When people turn their back on wrestling, right? 35 years ago, it isn't like it is today. He gave me an award for my work with the youth in Tampa. A soldier had fallen in Vietnam, and his family gave Eddie with the state senator the flag
that his
coffin came back in. I mean, if a police officer got shot or hurt in the line of duty, Eddie paid for the bill. Same thing, firefighter got lost. Eddie paid for the bills. So when you're seeing this on TV, right?
Right.
You're saying to yourself, boy, this is a class act. At the end of the night, they're doing this at the beginning of the show, right?
Correct.
And at the end of the show, Gordon could say, my God, Dusty's actually going to hang Kevin Sullivan. He's hanging him. Blood skirting out of my head. People turn the other way and say, oh, that doesn't matter. They do great things.
And they did. You talk about the Florida Sheriff's Youth Boys Youth Ranch, and I know he's very involved in amateur wrestling and donating to the University of Florida.
He started amateur. I jumped all over you, but he started the amateur wrestling program in high schools in Florida. He bought the first mat.
Yeah.
He did a lot of good.
Yeah, and that's why he was honored by him and Cowboy Luttrell. That's why we honored them, and they were honored by the county commission. And you say the truth, my friend. It was just like you said, at the beginning of the show, the mayor would come out and present an award or a city councilman, and by the end of the show, all hell is breaking loose, as Gordon would call it, a Pier 6 brawl. So you go from Florida to, if I'm correct, San Francisco. Is that right?
I had a great chance to work on top at the Cow Palace. I just recently went back to the Cow Palace for a show. They drew 4,000 people. It brought back great memories. I wrestled in the Cow Palace. I was I wrestled Root 4 times for the U.S. belt there. I also was the partner of the greatest performer I've ever seen, the great Ray Stevens. I know the Heartbreak Kid and Rick are up there, but to me, you know, everybody has a favorite, and it's not hard. And the other one, Johnny Valentine. So I had a chance to go there. Then after there, I went to Kansas City. Then after Kansas City, I went to the Knoxville area for Ronald Fuller. Then he had two areas, and he sent me to Pensacola. And after, after Tennessee, I went to Pensacola. Then I went to Georgia when it became, you know, TBS became Nationwide.
Okay. Going back to San Francisco, you talked briefly mentioned main evented four times against Roop. Were you booking or was Roop booking?
Roop was booking, but it was the angle I did with my father that got over. But Bob, he allowed the angle.
Was that based on the Steve? Was that based on the Steve Kern angle that they did with Bob in Florida?
No, it was different. What the angle was that Bob was like a member of the family, and I had a younger brother, and they ended up wrestling in a tournament. It was for the Florida belt, and again, you couldn't do it today, the internet, that he crippled my brother with the shoulder breaker, and my brother could never wrestle again, and I said, when I first got there, only reason why I'm here is I'm going to kill you. And after I beat you, I leave. I wrestled him. We had, you know, the first Roy Shires had a way he booked was horrible. He did the same thing, a double count out, stopping double blood, and then he'd blow it off. Well, he did it the first two, and the third one, when I beat him, my dad came in the ring and congratulated me. And Roop drove me into the ropes, tied me up, and gave my father the shoulder breaker. And then we came back for the fourth time in the cage. So, yeah, so I got to work with Bob, and then I went to Kansas City. And then, like I said, from Kansas City, I went to Knoxville, which was a really pleasurable. David, think about this. You've been with the guy with me quite a bit.
Yes, sir.
We used to travel 220 miles a week. And one of the trips was 150 miles.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, we were home. You know, we all had boats. We all stayed at the lake. You know, and even back then, the heels kayfabe the baby faces.
So,
I mean, it was a great place. And then,
how many cities did you? How many nights a week did you work if you only did 220 in a week?
Six to seven.
That's a lot of spot shows.
Six to seven. Yeah, well, he ran Knoxville, which wasn't a trip, right? You're in your hometown.
Right.
They ran Marysville, which is where the airport is. That was 20 miles round trip. Johnson City was 50 miles round trip. And they ran Harland, which was 60 miles round trip. And then they run a couple of spot shows, and this was funny, Dave. I never have seen it work any other place but Knoxville. They would run a different end of Knoxville in a smaller building with a different card than they would run in the big building and draw. So, I mean, you were home every night. It was a great place. And then Ronald was nice enough. He was there for a while. He said, you want to go to the southern end, and I went to the southern end, had a great time living on the beach, and then they asked me to go to Georgia, and that's when TBS started and, you know, got some national publicity.
When you were in Georgia, when did you start to feel like this was something different than a regular territory? When, how far in? Because I know you were in right when it was exploding.
I was on the first tour that left, okay? And we went to Columbus, Ohio. And when I wrestled on the first match, and I locked up with Steve Kern, and the people popped, right? I watched the last match, and it was Tommy Rich against Buzz Sawyer, I believe. And the ring was filled with litter, okay? As they came, as Tommy came to the ring, and the litter was keys to hotel rooms and girls' underwear. He was like Elvis Presley. I had never seen anything like this in my life. And to this day, I mean, I work with Hogan. I work with them all. I never saw anybody over with the women like he was. It was ridiculous.
So that's when you had a feeling that something special was going on, huh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I knew it was. We were like, you know, a destination that you always wanted to go to. Like, people say, well, next year I'm going to go to the Grand Canyon. They're having a few drinks at a bar, and then the year goes by, and they say, by God, I'm going this year. Well, the Grand Canyon was coming to them. They were seeing it right off of TV at 6:05, and they went. And they went in droves.
When you were in Georgia, you were involved in an extremely famous angle that I watched last night, actually, knowing that we were going to have this interview, because I could watch it once a year, if not twice. Anyway, but you know what angle I'm talking about?
The two flat tires?
The four flat tires. The
flat tires.
The Freebirds and Austin Idol. Talk to me about whose idea that was and your memories of that angle, because that angle lives in infamy in a great way.
Here's why it works so well. Idol and I did the same kind of angle that I was out to kill him and I want to leave. And we had a lot of matches in the Omni, and all of a sudden, he saved Tommy Rich against Mark Lewin, who eventually became my partner, and Abdullah the Butcher. And they would do sometimes really subtle angles. And I used to get on TV, and like Tommy Rich coming up to me and says, you know, sometimes you got to let shit go, Kevin. I said, bullshit. I'll hate him to the day I die. I can't stand him. You can like him, Tommy, all you want. I hate him. And they did this, and they would say, well, he wants to come here and shake your hand. I said, that ain't working, brother. I'm not shaking his hand. And that would keep it going. And then he was wrestling Mark, and the concession stand was right outside the babyface door. And they had me go out like I was going to go get some popcorn. Well, they had Abdullah run down the aisle, and the fans literally pushed me down the aisle to make the save. But my interview was, after I made the save with him, we were booked to wrestle him, and I used to say, you know, now I know I've reached the bottom, that I'm scum like you, Idol. Because I'll do anything for money. Every time I look in the mirror before I shave, I think if I had any guts, I'd be cutting your face instead of teaming with you. And we played it up for a long time, and we never patched it up. And, we kept the angle going, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
And I think that's why I got in the four flat tires, you know, I never said four flat tires. It was great. And, hey, the Freebirds, they're in the Hall of Fame. They're fabulous. They were great.
And you just kept saying throughout the whole show, he gave me his word, Gordon. He gave me his word.
Yeah. He'll be here. He'll be here. He gave me his word, you know. And it was one of those things that worked, too. I think it was because we were, you know, he was flamboyant. I was more of the blue collar baby face. And it worked. But it worked because the Freebirds were very special. They drew, a lot of people don't understand how much money the Freebirds drew. They drew a lot of money.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, any other memories of that time with in Georgia when the Superstation was making it national?
Yeah, you know, I went up. I was like in a test market. They sent me up before they actually took the territories over. They sent me to West Virginia, and the Sheik had Bluefield, West Virginia. And that wasn't drawing anything. And they sent me up cold against him, and it drew a big house. And that's when they decided we're going nationwide. If we take our whole crew, we'll sell out. And that's what they did. And here's the crazy thing. The Sheik and I became dear, dear friends. They offered him 10% for life, and he turned it down. He thought he was going to rebuild the territory against the national television program. Crazy.
But that is a crazy story. But they didn't. They did not run against territories. They only ran where there weren't territories for the most part. Is that correct?
Yeah, they didn't run against anybody else but the Sheik because he had let it die.
Right.
He was running, you know, he wasn't running a territory. He was running an occasional spot show. And at first they were paying him 10%. And then they finally came to him and said, I'm not talking about school because he was one of my dearest friends. They came to him and said, hey, we'll give you 10% of Detroit, Cincinnati, all the kind of shows. He said, no. I'm going to get my TVs. And he didn't have TV back then in those towns. He said, I'm going to get my TV back and I'll be doing it. And it just killed him.
That's sometimes in this business, as we have all found out, pride could get in your way a little bit of the pocketbook, so to speak.
Yep.
So around this time, you also were in Memphis as part of Jimmy Hart's stable. You know, Jimmy Hart is one of my great friends and one of your great friends, and we worked together a lot later on. Tell me about your memories of working with Jimmy. This would have been when he first started out, a couple years in as a heel manager in Memphis, Tennessee. Tell me, and working with Jerry Lawler, and tell me a little memories about that and working with Jimmy.
The trips were brutal.
That's what I've heard.
But Jimmy, yeah, they were brutal. But Jimmy was keep on dancing, baby. You know, we go into a restaurant, I'll have well done chicken, a bowl of soup, and some crackers.
When you think it's too well done, cook it some more. I've heard it a million times.
You got it. And Jimmy kept you laughing, and he kept it going, and he made it fun, and it was a very, very difficult place to work. It was very political, and Jimmy knew how to play the game there, and he lasted a long time, and he's done very well in the business. He's a hard worker, which we both know.
Absolutely. So we've gone through about the first 12 years of your career, and you obviously were all over the place and had a lot of success. Other than learning from Eddie Graham and Vince McMahon Sr., did you get a chance at that point to book anywhere?
Oh yeah, I booked Knoxville. I booked Puerto Rico for a while. I booked helped Luke Williams in San Antonio. I actually booked a San Francisco group. And so my first, and then I booked Knoxville again. And then I booked Georgia for a while for Jim Barnett.
Oh, that I didn't know. Wow.
Yeah, I booked it for a short period when there was some friction going on. Do you remember when there was a split with Ole and Jim?
No, I don't. You want to tell the story?
Well, there was they had 2 hours of TV. There was a split. That was before, you know, the Black Saturday or whatever it's called that Vince took over, and then he sold it to Crockett. But right. Ole had the TV in the morning. Jim had the TV in the afternoon. Robert was the booker, and I replaced Robert for a short period, and that's when the sale went on.
Oh, I never knew that.
And then after that, I went down to Florida.
And that's where we pick up, because that sort of changed your career a little bit.
Yep.
And so you came down to Florida in 82 to book?
No, I came down to Florida to be Dust. To be a baby face. And I took it on my own to cut a promo that irritated Dusty, and he came out because it got to his pride. I went out and I said, this stuff that he said, and they said it up perfectly because I had been a heel in Knoxville and I had just come from Knoxville, and Barry and Blackjack owned the territory. And they were saying, I was not to be trusted. And Mike was saying, and Mike's friends were saying, hey, we've all done things we didn't like. My father was not a fan favorite at different times. Blackjack, people hated you. Barry, people didn't like you. And I said, yeah, I made a lot of mistakes in my life, and I regret them. And I'm going to do the best I can. And we had a match, Barry and I, and we went 59 minutes on TV. Have you ever been in the Sportatorium, David?
You know, I never was. I never was, believe it or not.
I was there. I wrestled them in this time of year. It must have been 110 degrees. And the finish was, it was for the tournament. Mike was the commentator. And the match, Barry took I took a bump out of the ring, and Barry sat in the ropes and held the ropes up for me to get back into the ring. Then when it's about 30 seconds later, the same thing happened, but was reversed. Barry ended to the floor. As Barry came in, I held the ropes open, and I kicked him in the face and beat him. And Mike Graham said, what the hell are you doing? And I had to just take the belt, and I said, I'll show you what I'm doing. And I laid it into Mike's head, and he started to bleed. But the funny thing was, he wanted to kill me. But he had, do you remember when some of the Levi's had the buttons, right? It blew all the buttons off his pants, and he's chasing me, and I'm running into the dressing room, and he's trying to hold up his pants. Yeah, so that's how I started the angle, and then the angle was a progression. I didn't start putting eye makeup on till the second week, and then talking in tongues and different things.
As far as that character, when you came to Florida, when you came to Florida, did you know you were playing that character? And if so, whose idea was it?
No, the character started at A, and I went to Z with it. I just kept on putting it. I hit it on the right time. The genre MTV had just started, right?
Right.
The film genre was horror movies, right?
Right.
I got a lot of that stuff. There was a lot of dark videos. Michael Jackson's Thriller, Billy Idol, you know.
Right.
The Rolling Stones. So I've always tried to keep up. I'm a history buff, but I try to keep up with the times too. And I saw, wow, this is a different time. The music's different. The music had gone from the Beatles to this hard, hard black, you know, Black Sabbath, AC/DC,
heavy metal.
Ozzy Osbourne, yeah. Biting a rat, you know what I mean?
Right.
Or a bat. It became quite the thing. So it was good. It was good.
So you didn't start out saying, I'm going to be the devil. It sort of just was how it transpired. You just kept building
and here's the funny thing, David. I never used the word devil. I used the word Abuda Dean.
Right.
And I learned that because when I go places, I study where I'm going. Like, I remember I got heat with Taz because I said, how can you be the Tasmaniac where you don't even know where Tasmania is? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I went to Singapore. You know, I used to wrestle in that part of the world quite a bit. I went to Malaysia. And I went to the cave temples of Ipoh, and they're 2,500 years old, and they have all these deities. And they had this one very weird deity. And the guy I was with was, you know, Singaporean, and they speak about 9 languages, very intelligent people. And I said to him, what is this? He says, that's the evilest of all. And I said, why is it the evilest at all? He says, he's the creator and the destroyer. He's also looked upon as a fertility god. And at your death, you're supposed to see him. And I said, what's his name? He told me. And I said, that's a good name. I'll keep that one. And then, you know, then I had... Bill Otten put something ridiculous on the cover. This day he denies it. He blames somebody else. You know, it was the devil's my manager. What did the devil and I make a pact? Come
pact
on.
With the devil,
please.
Yeah.
So, you know, one thing led to another. Here I am, David. I'm a conservative Irish Catholic from South Boston. You know, when I was sitting at a table at Thanksgiving, I had an aunt that was a nun, an uncle that was a priest. One of my uncles worked for the famous Whitey Bulger, and my dad was a cop. The other one was a politician. So, you know, that's the furthest thing I was, you know, so...
Was there ever a point where you thought you pushed it too far? Or you said, there's no way that I'm going to get away with that?
No, because the people had bought the story. If I ever had started, we'll say at the letter O, it would have been too much. At the beginning, you know, I misunderstood, and then I start putting the dark makeup on. And you got to remember the era, right?
Right.
What was Miami built on in that area? Cocaine.
Oh, right? Yeah, Miami Vice, all that stuff.
Yeah, so I started darkening my eyes, and I'd say in my interviews, I saw that brown elk following me. I mean, I was doing subtle things for my own enjoyment. Sometimes something would say, are you doing that for your own enjoyment or is that real? But it was a mixture of all because I remember, you know, you say that now and people say, wow, that was a horrible thing to say. I remember the cover of Time magazine when the AMA came out and said cocaine was not addictive or harmful. You know what I mean? So it was, Florida, you're from Florida, it was party central.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Yeah, so, I mean, I remember there was 37 cops that worked at the Miami Beach Auditorium, you know, the Jackie Gleason Auditorium.
Right.
All 37 got busted. So, I mean, it couldn't, I don't know if it could happen today. I know Rotunda's son plays a terrific role. I mean, a wonderful role. I get off to watching him. He's terrific, and he can move. But, you know, it was just the time, too, Dave. I think it was, you know, MTV being brand new. Now nobody watches MTV. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
even think they have videos. I can't tell you the last time I watched MTV.
They don't have videos. They have Teen Moms. And the only reason I know that is because my wife watches. But so did you have back in the day when the Purple Haze was coming in from the Walking Out of the Ocean and Bob Roop was Mayus saying with half his head and mustache and beard shape, did you have creative control or were you actually booking at that point?
I had creative control. Dusty was nice enough to give me creative control.
It's funny how
go ahead and, yeah.
We'll get back to creative control in a whole different environment, but tell me about meeting Luna and your memories of working with her as a young lady.
She was my baby. I absolutely, Dave Heath and Luna are two of my favorite people of all times. I'll tell you a story about Luna. You know, I did an angle with Luna where it was who was the most popular wrestler in Florida. It was between me and Barry. And you got to remember, she was 19 years old, and Trudy had this little curly blonde hair. She looked like Shirley Temple.
Right.
And I said to her, hey, when we go out there, I'm going to lay it in. She said, you better. I'm a Vachon, you know. Well, when they gave it to Barry, I slapped her. She went up in the air, you know, straight up. And I come back, right, into the dressing room, and she says to me, I thought you were tough. You're a pussy. Next time, lay it in there. I said, okay. A quick sidebar, okay? Mike and I are working in a club years later. We're tying our boots. The match had gone on before. A manager screwed the spot up, right?
Right.
Luna was on him, beating him up, and took his cane and was smacking his head, right? And all the other wrestlers looking at me and Mike, and we're just lacing up our boots. They say, aren't you going to do something? Mike says, no, we've seen the show too many times. We know who's going to go over.
Well,
she was a wonderful, wonderful girl. I miss her to this day. She was, and a wonderful friend. She was a wonderful friend.
So during this time, or somewhere around this time, you were splitting your time. You and your crew actually were splitting your time in Florida and also working for
Savoldi
and ICW. So how did that deal work out? As far did you go one week there and 1 week there? How did that work?
Here's how it worked. I think I might have started to clear that the other people didn't. They were in every major town that we were in, their TV, because their backer had Looney Tunes cartoons, right?
Right.
Everybody wants Looney Tunes cartoons, right? Every major network. So I called them and they saying, we're thinking about running the show. I said, can we have a meeting before you do that? And they were going to load the card up with Abdullah and everybody. So I told Hero, I'm going to go have the meeting. He gives me his blessings. I go and have the meeting. So they say, okay, we'll put your stuff on TV. You book it. You book both places, and we'll put your stuff on. And when you get the okay. One night I'm in the dressing room, And this is who I have in the dressing room. Superstar Billy Graham, Mark Lewin, King Curtis, Abdullah the Butcher.
I'm seeing a pattern.
Yeah, yeah. Blackjack Mulligan, Wahoo, Kendall Windham, Mike Rotunda, and Jumpin' Joe Savoli. So they had very limited guys. I didn't want that television program because they had signed it for a 2-year deal coming into our territory. And yeah, maybe they would have liked Florida wrestling better, but they were on a better channel. They were on like a regular network, which we were on, a UHF. We were on Channel 44 back in the day in Tampa. Right. You know what I'm saying? So I got to book both of them. It got heat on me at the end. Somebody made up a story, and they sick canned me. So, but it did. And after that, Florida ended up going and getting in rough shape when Dusty stole everybody.
Yeah. So we talk about the. The end of championship wrestling from Florida in 1987. There was an angle right around that time that was one of my favorite. As I was in college at the time, University of Florida, when you sort of came out of your 5-year spell, but it seemed like now Crockett had bought the territory. It seemed like in hindsight, knowing what I know now, it seemed like you were setting up to where you were going to team with Dusty, which would have been a huge deal in Florida, but something happened and you cut this crazy promo where you like fainted on the halfway through at the desk, and it ended up being Blackjack. Is there any backstory to that? Am I sensing that was correct?
No, you're absolutely right. I'm sure your friends were passing the bong around laughing.
I can't cop to that. I've already copped to some stuff earlier in the show before I brought you up, but I can't cop to that.
But here's the thing. They came to me and said, we're in trouble. You know, Dusty's taking everybody. We need you to turn babyface. And I said, there's no way I can turn babyface. They said, well, turn with Jack. I said, there's only one person that can turn me babyface, and that's not disrespecting Blackjack Mulligan because he put me over more than anybody. I said, it's only Dusty. Then he said, well, how are you going to turn if he doesn't save you? I said, let me turn on myself. He said, what on yourself? And I had Humperdinck there. I'd be talking Monday, Wednesday night in Miami Beach. I got a bull rope match against Terry Funk. I'm going to kill it. And Humperdinck said, you don't have a bull rope match. You have a Texas death match. It's against Dorian. That's what I said. No, it's not. And I keep on mumbling, and then I pass out. And we were going to do the Dusty. We were going to do the Dusty finish with him and me. And we did it one time, and it drew big. It drew really big in Lakeland. And I'm not sure if Crockett didn't want it to succeed because he wanted to close that territory down because he hadn't closed the deal with Mike yet. And Mike had money. And when Mike saw that, he thought there was going to be a revival. And Dusty said, no, we're going all over. We won't have time to do that angle here. So there was a little, you saw it right.
So you had to. So then you made it with Blackjack, and that, you know, the that one promo is on YouTube. But that's the only part of that angle that's on YouTube. The one promo where you
really
transferred it. You know, you said it was going to be the head of the family, but you know, I forget the exact verbiage where you transferred the heat, so to speak, to Blackjack. But that one, you got to search a little bit. But that one's on. But the rest of that whole buildup, for whatever reason, you got tons of stuff on YouTube. Is not on YouTube, and it was some of the most, when you turned on yourself and almost sort of was coming out of the fog, some of the most, I'm not kissing your ass. I don't need to. We've been friends a long time.
Yeah.
And there's been times you didn't like things I did. And you didn't hide that either, but that was some of the most entertaining stuff that I've ever seen in this business. And that covers a lot. It's a shame that it's not available, because it was good stuff. But ultimately the territory did go out of business, unfortunately. Yeah. And you headed up to Jim Crockett Promotions. Did you stop anywhere in between, or was it a pretty seamless jump from Florida to Crockett?
That was a pretty seamless jump from Florida to Crockett. But at that time, they were still, Crockett was running both Atlanta and the Carolinas, and I was mostly in Atlanta. But then it was get merged quickly. That was only for about 3 months.
Right. And was the, I'm assuming, just because you're such a creative guy, that the Varsity Club was your idea?
No, I'm going to give Dusty his dues. That was Dusty's idea.
Really?
It was like, what's wrong with this pitcher? Three, college athletes. What's wrong with the pitcher? I gave him some input on it, but it was his idea. He wanted me to wear a Letterman jacket. I said, no, it's like, what's wrong with these kids? These kids are straight and narrow. Oh, we know what's wrong with them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was like, I was kind of like maybe ahead of my time where, some guys earn all this money and they go off the deep end. And like that Johnny Manziel, the kid that used to be the quarterback for the Browns.
Right.
Remember? So that's kind of where we got it. But that was Dusty's. Dusty was very, very brilliant.
And the stuff with Steiner, where he eventually turned babyface and became a huge fan favorite when he was bickering and arguing, is that just him being him and it went from there? Or was that all part of the angle?
Well, I saw the people turning, they was doing the ooh, 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 the dog face gremlin. And I went to Dusty and said, you can't keep this kid heel any longer. We got maybe a month, so let me start pushing him around for the month. And then when we did push him around for the month, we went around him and I, and I'll give you a quick funny story. The Detroit Pistons had just beaten the Boston Celtics for the NBA championship. So we went to the Gardens and it was sold out, and we were in the semi-main, and I said, this is your first time here as a babyface. Go out and let the people go crazy for you. So he goes out, and I get the announcer in on it, right? And the first thing is, and here he comes coming down the aisle, and the whole building's going, ooh, ooh, ooh. And Marvin Hagler, you remember him?
Right.
The middleweight champion. He's sitting in the front row with his kid. He goes, and come on down the aisle, the dog-faced gremlin, from the home of the new NBA world champions, the Detroit Pistons. The building turned instantly, started booing the shit out of Rick. I'm coming down the aisle, and it says, and coming back home to the home of the greatest franchise in basketball history, I was over. Things coming into his ears, out of his ears, right? We lock up. He nails me. I wish he had just gone and hit me as hard as he could, because the working punch knocked me out. He shoots me in the ropes and gives me a clothesline. I'm like Linda Blair. My neck turns, right? I fall out of the ring, and I'm pulling myself up. Who am I pulling myself up to? Marvin Hagler. It wasn't planned. I looked at him. I said, brother, I need a hand. And he looked at me, dead cold eyes, and said, brother, you're on your own tonight.
So that was a rib on Rick Steiner. That
yeah, it was a rib on myself.
Yeah, you ribbed yourself. So at that very moment, you knew what all the enhancement guys that had worked with you in Florida for all those years felt like.
Correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
because you were pretty you're pretty famous for laying it in. Any thought process behind that?
Yeah, because I'll tell you how it started. I always was snug, but I was never stiff. In was there. Eddie was always at TV. And I was the top heel at the time. And this kid that came through, he got booked somewhere. He was in Georgia, and somebody's friend got him booked because, you know, they just didn't give guys a job there. And right. I feel very sorry for this. You know, I believe in karma. You pay for shit that you do. The guy says to me, I'm a butcher. When I go back tomorrow to work, I'm going to tell them that you're a hell of a nice guy, because I was talking to him, right?
Right.
And he said, I'm going to tell him you're a hell of a nice guy. Well, Eddie pulls me aside and says, I better see something or you're gone. I said, what do you mean? He said, he better be crawling when he comes through that door, or you can pack your bag. Well, I tacked him, threw him outside, threw him through, you know, that little retaining wall, and I got a chair, and I hit him with the chair, and I knocked him out, threw him in, covered him, and Eddie said, you kept your job. I didn't want him going back next day and saying, oh, that shit's all fake. He says, now he's going to go back with us. He fought you tooth and nail. He's got stitches in his head. And anybody else, I was stiff, but I never intentionally hurt anybody. I thought that was bullshit. I hate this thing about the Hall of Fame. The Hall of Fame should be for the great performers like George Jackson, the kid Jackson.
Mike Jackson.
Mike Jackson, Bob Cook, name them, great kids in Florida.
Yeah.
There's so many. They should be in the Hall of Fame, not the guys that Hall of Fame. I mean, come on. None of us hit 50 home runs. None of us threw 30 touchdown passes. Those are the guys that need to be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and a guy like Bob, I know Bob Cook, and a guy like Bob Cook would be tremendously humbled to hear that, and I'll let him know later on today that that you mentioned him. But yeah, those are the guys that that you know, didn't have a ton of fame and didn't make a ton of money, but they were the ones who let you guys go out to Miami Beach and, you know, all over the country at one point, main event, because, you know, they made you look like $1 million.
Right.
So I certainly understand where you're coming from. Before I sign off this week, I wanted to wish a happy wedding to our associate producer, Mike Freeland, who got married this weekend, and appreciate everything that he's done for this project. And so congratulations, Mike, and your lovely bride. Enjoy your honeymoon, and we'll catch up when you return. Other than that, we'll be back next week with the rest of the Kevin Sullivan interview, talking about all kinds of stuff, WCW and beyond. So please be safe. We appreciate your input, positive or negative. And until next week, this is David Penzer. I'm still sitting ringside. Thank you, guys.
Follow David Penzer on Twitter at David Penzer. Also, make sure to follow the show on Twitter at Penzer Ringside. You've been sitting ringside with David Penzer on Radio Influence.
I'm Jerry Petuck, CEO of Radio Influence. I just wanted to take a quick moment to say thank you for downloading and subscribing to this podcast. There are a lot of people behind the scenes here at Radio Influence that work hard to keep you entertained day in and day out. If you'd like to get involved and advertise on this program, or you have some show ideas that you'd like to see us add to the Radio Influence family, please email us at contact@radioinfluence.com. We all have crazy schedules, so the fact that you took time out of your busy day to let us entertain you for a while means a lot. Without you, the listeners, we wouldn't exist, so thank you again for downloading and subscribing to this show. Don't forget to check out radioinfluence.com to see what other shows we also have to offer. All of Radio Influence's programming can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, radioinfluence.com.